My etiquette instincts about being an unplanned-for guest warred with the simple reality that I should eat, even if I wasn't hungry. Plus, if she was anything like my mother, I brushed the back of my hand over my eyes. If she was anything like my mother, then turning down food would be inhospitable. Under my bare feet, the kitchen's linoleum floor was cool. The walls had been painted mint green, and there were crisp white cabinets above pristine counters. Had she cleaned when they said I was coming, or was her house always this tidy? As she opened the refrigerator, I suspected the latter. She must have a friend that sold Tupperware, or maybe she did. The food was all in matching pastel containers. If I hadn't seen that moment of shock and grief as she watched the television, she might have stepped out of an advertisement for GE. Now, how about a ham and cheese sandwich? Oh, maybe just cheese? After the day you've had, you need to have some protein. Mama said it was always better to get the conversation over with. We're Jewish. She straightened, brows rising. Are you really? Well, I'd never have known to look at you. It was kindly meant. I know it was. I had to believe it was because I was a guest in her home and had nowhere else to go. I swallowed and smiled. So just cheese would be fine. What about tuna fish? That sounds lovely if it's not too much trouble. Neither of us came from families that had kept kosher. But after the war began, I'd stopped eating pork and shellfish. The discipline, if nothing else, helped me remember who I was and why that was important. Not a bit. She pulled a pale pink container from the fridge. Eugene always has tuna fish for lunch, so I keep some made up for him. Is there anything I can do to help? Just sit down. Another container, this one green, followed the first. It would be harder to explain where everything was than to just do it. On the wall by the refrigerator hung a dull brown wall phone. Somehow the sight of it hit me with guilt like a brick. I hate to impose, but may I borrow your phone? It would be a long-distance call, but... I trailed off, uncertain of when I could repay her. Of course. You want me to step out? No, it's fine. That was a lie. I desperately wanted the privacy, but I didn't want to impose on her any more than I already had. Thank you. She slid the sandwich fixings over on the counter and gestured to the phone. It's not a party line, so you shouldn't have to worry about anyone listening in. One of the benefits of staying in a major's house, hmm? I crossed to the phone, wishing it was in another room in the house, or that I had the guts to tell her the truth. After I dialed, I got that damnable circuit-busy sound. I managed not to curse. Well, not aloud, at any rate. I tried again, and the phone rang. The relief sapped my strength and left me leaning against the wall. With each ring of the phone, I prayed, please let them be home. Please let them be home. Please...
Hello, Wexler residence.
My brother's voice was calm and professional. Mine cracked. Herschel? It's Oma. A ragged gasp and then just the crackle of a long-distance line. Herschel? I have never heard my brother sob before, not even when he split his knee open to the bone. In the background, I could hear Doris, his wife, asking a question, probably, what's wrong?
Elma, no, she's alive. Oh, praise God, she's alive.
His voice came back to the microphone.
We saw the news. What about Mom and Pops?
No. I pressed my hand over my eyes and leaned my forehead against the wall. Behind me, Mrs. Lindholm made the sandwich with unnatural quiet. I had to press the words out of my throat. Nathaniel and I were out of town. Mom and Daddy were home. His breath shuddered in my ear.
But you and Nathaniel are alive.
Do you know, how did Charleston fare?
The city was hit by tidal waves, but a lot of people were able to evacuate.
Then he answered the question I was actually asking.
We haven't heard from Grandma or any of the aunts.
Well, I had a time getting a clear circuit through. Doris said something, and Herschel's voice muffled for a moment.
What? Yes, I'll ask.
His wife had always been the more organized of the two, even while they were courting. I smiled, picturing the list that she was probably making right now.
Where are you? What do you need? Are you hurt?
We're at the Wright-Patterson base in Ohio. Well, actually, we're at the home of the Lindholms who have taken us in tonight. So don't worry, I'm well taken care of. I glanced over my shoulder. Mrs. Lindholm had cut the sandwich into neat quarters and trimmed the crust off. In fact, I should probably go since I'm calling on her phone.
Next time, call me collect.
I'll call tomorrow, if the circuits aren't busy. Give my love to Doris and the children. When I hung up, I stood with my head against the wall, as if the mint green paint could cool my forehead. I think it was only a moment. One of the chairs creaked as if Mrs. Lindholm had sat down, so I gathered myself and straightened. Daddy had always said that deportment was important for an officer and a lady. Thank you. My brother's been very worried.
I'm sure I would be, too.
She had set the sandwich on a bright teal plate and then centered it in the middle of a placemat. Next to the plate stood a glass of water with beads of condensation on its side. The mundanity of the kitchen, the ticking clock on the wall, the hum of the refrigerator, and this kind woman with her sandwiches, placemats, and flannel pajamas seemed completely separate from the world I had been in all day. The images of the burned children on television might as well have been on Mars for all the connection they had to hear. The chair creaked as I sat, and my joints ached with frustration. As I'd been taught, I put the napkin in my lap and picked up the first quarter of the sandwich. I was lucky. We had owned a plane and a way to get out. Is the sandwich all right? I had eaten a quarter of it and not noticed. My mouth tasted of dying fish and rotting pickles. I smiled for my hostess. Delicious. 5.
Tidal wave strikes Venezuela. Caracas, Venezuela, March 4th, 1952, AP. A tidal wave, believed to be caused by the meteorite which struck off the coast of North America, hit the port of Vela de Coro, inflicting heavy damages, reports to the government said today. Ships anchored in the western Venezuela port were destroyed, and many houses along the waterfront were flattened, the report said. The extent of the casualties is not yet known.
At some point, I must have fallen asleep on the couch. I woke up to Nathaniel's touch on my forehead. The light from the kitchen streamed into the dark living room and caught on the white dress shirt he wore. He was clean and had showered, and for a disorienting moment, I thought that I had dreamed it all.
Hey.
He smiled and brushed the hair back from my forehead again.
Do you want to sleep out here or go to the bedroom?
When did you get home? Back. I sat up, stretching the crick out of my neck. One of Mrs. Lindholm's afghans had been pulled up over my shoulder, and the television was a dark ghost in the corner.
Just now. Major Lindholm brought me.
He nodded toward the kitchen.
He's making a sandwich.
Did you get something to eat? He nodded.
They fed us in the meeting.
Nathaniel offered his hand and helped me to my feet. All of the cuts and aches and bruises that I had acquired during the day found me in the dark. The backs of my calves burned with each step. Even my arms protested as I folded the afghan. Was it too soon to take another aspirin? What time is it?
Nearly midnight.
If he was only just now getting back, the situation was not good. In the dim light, his features were too blurred to read. In the kitchen, Major Lindholm scraped his knife across a plate. I set the afghan down. Let's go back to the bedroom. He followed me down the dimly lit hall to the room that Mrs. Lindholm had put us in. It had belonged to her eldest son, Alfred, who was off at Caltech getting a degree in engineering. While there was a leopard's pennant from his high school, the partially assembled director set in the Jules Verne collection might have come out of my childhood room. Everything else was plaid or red, which I suspected was his mother's touch. When the door was closed, Nathaniel reached for the light, but I stopped him. For a little while longer, I wanted to be in the safety of the night. Here, with just the two of us and no radio to remind us, we might just be visiting someone. My husband pulled me into his arms and I leaned against him, nestling my cheek into the contour of his chest. Nathaniel rested his chin against my head and ran his hands through my still damp hair. He smelled of an unfamiliar minty soap. I nestled against him. You showered on base? His chin rubbed the back of my head as he nodded.
I fell asleep at the table, so they took a break. I showered to wake up.
Pulling back, I looked up at him. The shadows seemed deeper around his eyes. Those bastards. After everything he'd been through today, they kept him awake? They didn't just send you home?
They offered.
He squeezed my shoulders before releasing me. Unbuttoning his shirt, he meandered toward the bed.
I was afraid that if I left, Colonel Parker would do something stupid. He still might.
He's a schmuck. Nathaniel stopped undressing with his shirt halfway down his arms.
You mentioned knowing him?
He was a pilot in the war, commanded a squadron, and hated having women fly his planes. Hated it. And he was grabby. In hindsight, I should not have mentioned that last bit to my husband. Not when he was exhausted. He straightened so fast I thought he was going to rip his shirt.
What?
Trying to soothe him, I held up my hands. Not with me, and not with any of the women in my squad. Well, not after I had a talk with Daddy. I shrugged. Benefits of being a general's daughter. He snorted and went back to sliding his shirt off.
That explains a lot.
Scrapes and bruises mottled his back.
I think I have him convinced that it wasn't an A-bomb, but he's certain that the Russians aimed the meteor.
They haven't even gotten off the planet yet.
I pointed that out.
He sighed.
The good news is that the chain of command is not as broken as he would like us to believe. General Eisenhower is flying back from Europe. Should be here tomorrow morning, in fact.
I took Nathaniel's shirt from him and hung it on the back of a chair. Here, as in Wright-Patterson, or as in America?
Here. It's the closest intact base.
The numbers sat quietly between us. We were more than 500 miles from the impact site. In the morning, I had my first glimpse of what we would be like as old people. Nathaniel could barely get out of bed on his own. During the earthquake, most of the debris had hit him. His back was a collection of hematomas and contusions that would have been better suited to one of Mama's medical textbooks than a living man. I was not much better. The only time I recalled feeling worse was the summer I'd had influenza. Still, I could get up, and I was fairly certain that once I was moving around, I'd be in better shape. Nathaniel took two tries to push himself into a sitting position on the edge of the bed. You should rest. He shook his head.
Can't. Don't want General Eisenhower to be swayed by Parker.
My foolish husband held out a hand, and I pulled him to his feet. General Eisenhower does not strike me as the sort of man to be swayed by an idiot.
Even geniuses can be stupid when they're scared.
He grunted as he stood, which did not fill me with anything like confidence. But I know my husband, and he's the sort of man who will work until his death. He reached for his shirt and winced. I picked up the bathrobe he'd been loaned and held it out. Do you want a shower first? Might loosen you up. He nodded and let me help him into the bathrobe, then shuffled down the hall. I went to the kitchen to find Mrs. Lindholm. The unmistakable aroma of bacon met me before I was through the door. I braced myself to have that conversation with every meal. They were kind people and we'd be sleeping in a field if not for them. Well, maybe that was a little melodramatic. We would have slept in the plane, but still. And then I heard what they were talking about, and the bacon became insignificant.
Keep thinking about the girls I went to school with. Pearl was in Baltimore.
Mrs. Lindholm's voice broke.
There now.
Sorry, I'm being such a goose. You want raspberry or strawberry jam with your toast?
I rounded the corner while the topic was innocuous. Mrs. Lindholm bustled at the counter with her back to me. She wiped a hand under her eyes. Major Lindholm sat at the kitchen table. Coffee steamed in a cup held loosely in his right hand. He had a newspaper in the left but was frowning over it at his wife. As I entered, he looked around and put a smile on like a mask.
Hope we didn't wake you last night.
Nathaniel did, which was just as well, or I would have woken with the worst crick in my neck. We went through the requisite pleasantries while he supplied me with a cup of coffee. Do I have to explain the glories of a fresh cup of coffee? The deep, redolent steam rising from the cup woke me before the first gloriously bitter drop even touched my lips. Not just bitter, but caressing waves of dark alertness. I sighed and relaxed into my chair. Thank you.
What about breakfast? Eggs? Bacon? Toast?
Mrs. Lindholm pulled a plate out of the cupboard. Her eyes were only a little red.
I have some grapefruit.
How far inland had Florida's citrus groves been? Eggs and toast would be lovely, thank you. Major Lindholm folded his paper and pushed it away from him.
That's right. Myrtle mentioned that you were Jews. Come over during the war?
No, sir. Oh. I looked up as Mrs. Lindholm set a plate with eggs and toast in front of me. The eggs had been fried in the bacon grease. They smelled very good. Damn it. I used the act of buttering my toast to collect my thoughts. My family came over in the 1700s and settled in Charleston.
Is that so?
He sipped his coffee.
I never met a Jew before the war.
Oh, you probably did, but they had their horns hidden.
Ha!
He slapped his knee.
Fair point.
Actually, my grandmother. The toast and butter required all of my attention. My grandmother and her sisters still spoke Yiddish in the home. Mrs. Lindholm settled in the chair next to me and watched as if I were an exhibition at the museum.
Well, I never.
A little frown deepened the creases in her forehead.
And did they, well, you said Charleston, did they have Southern accents?
I turned up the accent, which I'd learned to tone down in Washington.
Y'all want to come over for Rosh Hashanah? Well, mazel tov, y'all!
They laughed until tears streamed down their faces as I went through some of the Yiddish I knew with the Charleston accent turned on high. It hadn't sounded strange when I was growing up. I just thought that was the way Yiddish was pronounced, until we started going to synagogue in D.C. Nathaniel appeared in the doorway, moving with a little more ease.
Something smells good.
Mrs. Lindholm jumped up and fixed a plate for him. The major talked genially about nothing. We were all pretending so desperately that nothing was out of place. But the newspaper lying on the table showed a picture of New York City, transformed into a misshapen Venice, where the streets were watery canals framed by windowless skyscrapers. Finally, Major Lindholm looked at the wall clock, which read 10 till 9. He pushed back from the table.
Well, we should be getting on.
Nathaniel jumped to his feet.
Thank you for breakfast, Mrs. Lindholm.
My pleasure.
She kissed her husband on the cheek.
It's nice to have someone to talk to instead of the backside of a newspaper.
He laughed, and it was easy to see why she'd fallen in love with him.
What do you ladies have planned for the day?
Well,
she picked up his plate, Nathaniel's.
I thought I'd take Mrs. York in town to go shopping.
Shopping? I picked up the other plates, following her to the counter. I'd been planning on going in with Nathaniel. She tilted her head and stared at me as if I'd suddenly spoken Greek.
But you both need new clothes. I washed yours, but they really can't be salvaged for anything except maybe yard work.
Nathaniel must have seen my stricken look, but didn't understand it. I wasn't worried about money. The world had just ended and I was being sent shopping.
It's all right, Alma. Colonel Parker gave us a clothing allowance until we get my employment status sorted. So take the day and go shopping. There's nothing you can do at the base anyway.
And that was the problem. There was nothing I could do. Mrs. Lindholm pulled her Oldsmobile to a stop in front of a store in downtown Dayton. The awning over the storefront had a rip in it, and the windows of the shop had a thin grit coating them. They framed a display of smart dresses in vivid jewel tones. I got out of the car and looked down the street at the people going about their lives, as if nothing had happened yesterday. No, that wasn't quite true. The little clusters of people in conversation seemed to stand closer to each other than might be normal. The flag over the barber's shop next door stood at half-mast, and the same grit that clung to the store window dusted everything. I shivered and looked up at the odd ochre haze in the sky. Mrs. Lindholm saw my shiver and misinterpreted it.
Let's get you inside before you catch your death.
Oh, I'm getting good at outrunning death. Mrs. Lindholm's face blanched.
I'm so sorry. I forgot about what you went through.
Sometimes my humor doesn't work to diffuse a situation. This was one of those cases.
No, really, it's fine. It's just, I'm the one who should apologize. That joke was in poor taste.
No, it's my fault.
Really, no. You have nothing to apologize for.
I was being thoughtless.
I stopped and narrowed my gaze. I should remind you that I'm Southern, and you'll never win a politeness battle with me. She laughed, and people down the sidewalk turned to glare as if she had begun cursing in public.
Truce?
Absolutely. I gestured to the door. Shall we go in? Still laughing, she pushed the door open and set the shop bells to tinkling. The saleslady, a black woman in her late 60s with pristine white hair, stood next to a radio listening intently. At the sound of the bells, she looked around, though her gaze lingered on the radio.
The fires from the meteor strike yesterday have spread to cover 350 square miles.
She smiled as if she'd just remembered how to do it. May I help you? Then her gaze rested on me. Her frown was not obvious, just a tensing of her smile. All the ground-in dirt that no amount of washing could remove from my sweater grew to cover me. I must look homeless. Mama would be ashamed of me. I swallowed. I wanted to go back out to the car, but that would inconvenience Mrs. Lindholm, so I just stood, paralyzed, by the door. Mrs. Lindholm gestured to me.
My friend was in the East yesterday.
In the East. At the euphemism, the sales lady's eyes widened, and her brows peaked with pity.
Oh, you poor dear.
And then curiosity followed like a predator drawn to blood.
Where were you?
The Poconos. Mrs. Lindholm pulled out a navy blue dress from the rack and held it up.
She doesn't have anything except the clothes on her back.
A middle-aged white woman appeared from between the racks of clothing.
You were really there? You saw the meteor?
Meteorite. A meteor breaks up before impact? As if anyone cared about scientific accuracy. I think this might have been the last time I corrected someone. Meteorite, for whatever quirk of the English language, sounded almost cute. But no, we were 300 miles away. She stared at my face as if the cuts and bruises would give her a map to my specific location.
I have family back east.
So did I. I snatched a dress from the rack and fled to the changing room. The louvered door shut behind me, shielding me from their view, but not from their hearing. I sank onto the little padded bench and pressed both hands over my mouth. Every breath hurt, fighting to be given sound. 3.14159265.
She and her husband flew in last night. Lost everyone except a brother, I understand.
That's horrible.
358979323384. Everyone would know someone back east. I was not the only person who had lost family. The sales lady said,
I heard on the news that we should expect a lot more meteor refugees on account of Wright Patterson.
Meteor refugee. That's what I was. It's just that I was the first refugee that anyone had seen here. Of all the times for the tears to finally hit, it had to happen in a dress store?
That's what my husband was saying.
Mrs. Lindholm seemed to be just outside the door to my dressing room.
I'm going to go by the base hospital to volunteer later today.
That's so good of you.
Volunteer. I could do that. I could volunteer to fly refugees back from the east, or wrap bandages, or something. I'd done it during the war, and there was no reason not to pull myself together and do it again.
Is that the CBS you've got on the radio now?
I wiped my eyes and stood, reaching for the dress I'd snatched. It was a polka dot number in a size better suited for a pencil than for me.
Mm-hmm. They were just saying that they'd found a surviving cabinet member. Let me turn it up, if you ladies don't mind.
In the mirror, it looked as though a ghoul had come to shop. I'd thought I looked homeless, but really, I looked as if I hadn't truly survived the impact. Both of my eyes were blackened. I had tiny cuts all over my face and arms. Something had hit me right below my hairline and left a scrape. But I was alive.
And those tidal waves have also swamped the Caribbean, leaving many nations there without water or electricity. The devastation is said to number in the hundreds of thousands.
I opened the door of the dressing room and tried to tune out the radio. Silly me, it's the wrong size. The sales lady came over to help me, and we consulted on sizes and current fashion while the news continued in the background. It was like playing the fiddle while Rome burned around us. 6.
Indians offer aid to Mrs. Roosevelt. Questions by press underscore the growing friendship for United States. The Times. New Delhi, India. 4 March 1952. Questions put to Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt by Indian newspapermen at a Delhi Press Association luncheon for the former president's widow today underscored the significant, wide, and growing devastation in the United States after a meteorite struck earlier this week. Initially intended as a hospitality meeting, talks focused on offers of aid for United States.
The sky was a high silver overcast as Mrs. Lindholm dropped me off at HQ.
Are you sure you don't want to go home and rest, dear?
Thank you, but I really do feel better when I'm active. Her mouth turned down in disappointment, but to her credit, she didn't argue with me anymore.
Well, I'll be over at the base hospital if you need me. Don't forget to eat something.
Yes, ma'am. I waved as she drove off. Shopping was all well and good, and yes, I'll grant that I felt better with clean clothes and makeup to hide the worst of the bruising. But I'd spent the entire time we were out feeling like I was playing make-believe. In every store, a radio or television had been tuned to the news. Delaware basically didn't exist anymore. And the only surviving cabinet member they'd found so far was the Secretary of Agriculture. But there were still refugees that needed to be transported. I knew how to fly. So I brushed off my new polka-dotted navy blue dress, straightened its bright red belt, and headed inside to find Colonel Parker. He would not have been my first choice, mind you, but at least he knew my record of flying. I knocked on his door, which stood open. He sat at his desk, head bent over a memo. I swear his lips moved as he read. He developed a bald spot at the back of his head about the size of a half dollar. Wonder if he knew about it yet. He looked up, but didn't stand.
Mrs. York.
I saw on the news that the Air Force was mobilizing to deal with refugees. I came in and sat down without being asked. I mean, I didn't want to make him look bad about leaving a lady standing.
That's right. But don't worry, your husband won't be sent out.
Since he's not active service and was never Air Force, this does not surprise me. I breathed out, trying to let my irritation go with it. But I was wondering if I might help. With so many of our men still in Korea, I thought having an extra pilot might be useful.
Well, now, that's very kind of you, but this really isn't the place for a lady.
There are plenty of women among the refugees, and since I have first-hand experience... He held up his hand to stop me.
I appreciate your zeal, but it isn't necessary. General Eisenhower is recalling our troops, and there's an influx of UN aid.
What about Korea?
Ceasefire.
He shuffled the papers on his desk.
Now, if you'll excuse me.
Still, until they are home, you'll have a shortage of pilots.
Are you proposing to join the Air Force? Because if not, I can't let you fly one of our planes.
He made a mockery of regret.
And since your plane was damaged, I'm afraid there's really nothing for you to do here.
Well, I stood. He did not. Thank you for your time.
Of course.
He looked back down at the memo.
You might try nursing. I understand that's a good occupation for women.
Aren't you just so clever? Thank you ever so much, Colonel Parker. What truly aggravated me was that he was right. I wanted to help, but the skills I had were largely useless. Without a plane, what was I supposed to do? Math the problem to death? My timing when I arrived at the base hospital couldn't have been worse or better, depending on how you looked at it. A plane of refugees had just landed and swamped the hospital. Tents had been set up as a waiting area filled with people who had been outside for the last 2 days. Burns, dehydration, lacerations, broken bones, and simple shock. I was handed a tray of paper cups filled with electrolytes and told to distribute them. It wasn't much, but it was something useful.
Thank you, ma'am.
The blonde woman took a paper cup and looked down the rows of chairs to the doctors.
Do you know what's going to happen to us next?
The elderly man next to her shifted in his seat. His blackened eye was swollen nearly shut, and the blood crusted around his nose made it clear that he'd had a doozy of a nosebleed at some point.
Send us to camps, I reckon. I would have been better off staying where I was than sitting here.
Camps had a grisly connotation, and that sort of talk was not going to help anyone. I held my tray of paper cups out to the old man.
Drink, sir. It will help restore some strength.
God. That was my mother's doctor voice. Kind and brisk. He snorted and crossed his arms, but he winced when he did.
You're not a nurse. Not in that get-up.
He had a point. Still, I smiled at him. You're right. I'm just helping out. He snorted, and blood bubbled in one nostril. And then a gusher started.
Oh, hell.
Tilt your head back. I looked around for something to use to stop the blood. The young woman took the tray of water. Pinch the bridge of your...
I know. Am I first one?
But he still did as I said. A pasty man across the aisle in tattered business attire pulled his tie off and handed it to me. The lens of his glasses was cracked, and his eyes were more than a little glazed.
Thank you.
I pressed the silk against the old man's nose. This is the finest bandage I've ever had the pleasure of using. The old man took it from me and glared at the ceiling.
You're trying to distract me.
That I am.
I leaned forward to examine his eyes.
What would you like to talk about?
He pursed his lips.
You've been here, so you must know things. How bad is it?
I think. I looked around at the battered people surrounding us. I think that this is perhaps not the best time for that discussion. I'll just say that you are in a better position than many. Another topic?
All right.
He grinned a little, and I got the sense that he was enjoying his cantankerous role.
What do you think of Charles F. Brannan?
Who?
Secretary of Agriculture.
He turned the tie to a clean spot.
Way I hear it, he was in Kansas on a farm tour when the media hit. Unless they find someone else in the line of succession, looks like he's the new president.
The businessman who'd given us the tie said,
Acting president. Well now, that's a subject for debate, isn't it?
The old man was still glaring at the ceiling.
Constitutional scholars spend a whole heck of a lot of time talking about what exactly that means.
Under all of that grime, the old man was wearing a tweed jacket, complete with bona fide leather patches at the elbows. Where did you teach?
The Citadel.
Charleston?
My voice was too loud. People had turned to stare. I swallowed and tried again.
You were in Charleston?
The old man lowered his head a little and studied me out of his good eye.
You got people there.
Hometown?
I'm sorry.
He shook his head.
I was out on a hike with cadets, way inland. When we got back, well, I'm real sorry.
I nodded, clenching my jaw against the truth of what I already knew. The blast radius of the meteorite, followed by the tidal waves, meant there'd been little chance. But if I didn't know, then I could still hope. And hope would kill me. It took walking up the stairs of the synagogue to realize that entering that door meant admitting that my family was dead. The thought stopped me on the stairs, and I gripped the dusty metal railing. My family was dead. I had come to the synagogue because I needed to begin the mourning rites. Daddy was never going to pick up his trumpet again. Mama's giant cross-stitched bedspread would never be finished and was so much ash. My eyes closed of their own volition, blocking out the brick exterior and the scrubby little yew trees that flanked the stairs. Beneath the dark shield of my lids, my eyes burned. The grit under my hands was the same ash that drifted through most of the town. Ejecta from D.C.
Are you all right?
An older man's voice, with a hint of German to it, came from slightly behind me. I opened my eyes and turned with a smile, even though my eyes must be red.
Sorry, I didn't mean to block the way.
The man, who stood a step down, was not older than I was. Or if he was, it wasn't by much. His face, though, had a remnant of gauntness to it that I recognized. A Holocaust survivor.
You had family?
God, spare me from the kindness of strangers. I stared at the horizon, an amber haze over the Ohio plains.
Yes. So, I need to go in to talk to the rabbi.
He nodded and slipped past me to hold the door.
I myself am here for the same reason.
Oh, I am so sorry. I was such a self-centered schlub. I was hardly the only one with Jewish family in Charleston. And the damage to New York sounded extensive, and then D.C., and... How many of us had died, leaving no one behind to light the Yahrzeit candles and recite the Kaddish prayer? His shrug was small and sad as he gestured me through the door. I stepped into the foyer. Through the open doors, I could just make out the comforting light of the eternal flame hanging in front of the ark as a reminder. This man. He must have escaped Germany, only to have this happen when he thought he was safe. And yet he had survived. As had I. That's what we did. We survived.
and we remembered.
It is hard to sit Shiva in a Gentile's home. I compromised with myself and called our bedroom home, because I did not feel up to explaining to Mrs. Lindholm why I wanted to sit on low stools or cover the mirrors. Nathaniel walked in to find me sitting on the floor of our bedroom, pinning a torn ribbon to my shirt. I hadn't been able to bring myself to tear the shirt itself, not because the grief wasn't there, but to avoid the conversation about why I'd torn something we had just bought. He'd stopped, and his gaze went to the jagged tear in the ribbon. His shoulders sagged, as if the fact that I had performed Kriya alone let all the grief back in. My husband came over to sit on the floor beside me, pulling me into an embrace. The custom against speaking to someone in mourning until they spoke first had never made so much sense. I could not have spoken if I had tried. And I suspect neither could he. When the week of Shiva passed, I called every mechanic in the phone book. None of them had the parts or time to repair my plane. But I had to do something. I had survived, and there must be some reason for that. Some purpose or meaning or something. I took to going to the hospital with Mrs. Lindholm every day to roll bandages, clean bedpans, and serve soup to plane after plane after plane of refugees. They kept coming. I called the mechanics again, and then again. One of them made vague promises about maybe looking into ordering a propeller if he had time. If Nathaniel were home during the day, I would have asked him to make the call for me. But each night he came home even later than I did. Friday night, 2 weeks after the meteor, he came home well after sundown. Mind you, we had never been terribly religious about keeping the Sabbath before the meteorite, but somehow after it, I needed something, some continuity. I met Nathaniel at the door and took his coat from him. Major Lindholm, Eugene, and Myrtle had gone to a prayer meeting at their church, so we had the house to ourselves. You aren't supposed to work after sundown.
I'm a terrible Jew.
He leaned down to kiss me.
But I was occupied with convincing generals that no, the Russians could not have dropped the meteor on us.
Still? I hung his coat on a peg by the door.
The problem is that Parker had mentioned it to someone, probably several someones, and now it's spread through the military as, I heard there was a possibility that this was an offensive action by the Russians.
Ugh. I gestured toward the kitchen where the Lindholms had left the lights on. There's some chicken and potatoes if you haven't eaten.
You are a goddess.
You really are a terrible Jew. I laughed and pulled him into the kitchen. He dropped into one of the chairs with a groan, sliding forward to rest his head on the table.
Alma, I don't know how much longer I can survive these meetings. I keep saying the same thing over and over. Thank God that the UN's been called in, or there's no telling where we would be now.
Is there anything I can do to help? I pulled the refrigerator door open and found the plate I'd prepared for him. He straightened.
Actually, yes, if you have time.
In abundance.
Do you think you could calculate the size of the meteorite?
His voice broke a little as he asked, and he had to pause to stare at the table. Normally, a question like this would have gone to his colleagues at Langley. I pretended to busy myself with the plate to give him time to recover. We both tended to break at odd moments, and the tears were exhausting. Sometimes the best course was to pretend it wasn't happening. Nathaniel pressed his lips together in a dry grimace that tried to masquerade as a smile and cleared his throat.
I figure, if I know that, I can show that there's no possible way the Russians could have moved it.
I put the plate in front of him and kissed the back of his neck. Yes. I'm presuming you can get me government charts?
Just tell me what you need.
It's funny. I'd been helping Myrtle with refugees all week, but since they kept coming and each group was in worse shape than the last, it had felt like nothing had changed, like I made no difference in the world. I kept wondering why I had survived. Why me? Why not someone more useful? I know that's not logical or reasonable, and clearly I was helping people, but the jobs I was doing could have belonged to anyone. I was an interchangeable cog. Calculations? This pure abstraction of numbers belonged to me.
This I could do.
7. Civil Defense to use ham radios. Philadelphia, PA, March 17, 1952. To coordinate relief efforts after the meteor strike, civil defense agencies are using various types of emergency communications equipment to transmit messages in the disaster area. In addition to the customary telephone, officials are employing portable radio transmitting sets, walkie-talkies, army field telephone equipment, and amateur ham radio sets. These will be carried in cars manned by volunteer operators who will set up a secondary means of communication.
I worked on Nathaniel's calculations in the evenings. It helped to have the solace of numbers to retreat to after helping with the refugees during the day. Today, I had served soup to a group of Girl Scouts and their Scoutmasters. They had been on a camping trip when the meteor hit, and by sheer luck had been spelunking in the Crystal Caves. They'd felt the earthquake and thought it was disaster enough. Then they'd come up and everything was just gone. So, numbers. Numbers were solace. There was logic and order in the calculations. I could take disparate events and wring sense from them. The other place where I found order amid the chaos was in the kitchen. It had taken a week before Myrtle would trust me in the kitchen, and another couple of days before I convinced her to let me make dinner. Now we took turns. Was the kitchen kosher? Not even a little. Ask me if I cared. I opened the drawer next to the sink and rummaged through it until I found the measuring cups. Tonight I was making chicken pot pie. The fillin' simmered on the stove, scent in the air with the savory aroma of butter and thyme. In some ways, making pastry was like mathematics. Everything needed to be in proportion in order for the mass to come together. I walked over to the refrigerator, glancing into the living room. Myrtle sat on the couch, with her feet up on Eugene's lap. He was rubbing them while she sipped from a glass of wine.
Nothing you can do. I'm sorry, baby, I tried.
He grimaced and bent his head as he rubbed a thumb into the ball of her foot.
But I can't go where they don't send me.
It's just plane after plane of white folks. Where are our people? Who's rescuing them?
How had I not noticed that? I stopped with a hand on the refrigerator and ran through the refugees in my head, willing myself to see one spot of color amid the masses.
You know what would happen even if the brass were to send us to our people's neighborhoods. Say we pick them up and then what? Our people would be put in different camps.
She sighed.
I know, I know. I'll bring it up in church. See if we can get a relief effort going ourselves.
Measuring cup still in my hand, I walked over to the kitchen door. Excuse me. Myrtle looked around, and as she did, it was like a mask had slipped over her features. She smiled.
Do you need help finding something?
Oh, no. I couldn't help overhearing. Do you want Nathaniel to talk to someone? Eugene and Myrtle exchanged a glance that I couldn't begin to understand, and then he shook his head.
Thank you, ma'am. I think we've got this.
After dinner, I retreated to the Lindholm study. I had strewn papers all over the desk as I tried to pull the data points together into the order I needed. Opening the drawer, I pulled out the little notepad we were using as a logbook and jotted down the time so I could pay them back for the long-distance call. Then I picked up the receiver and dialed my brother's work number.
United States Weather Bureau. Herschel Wexler speaking.
Hey, it's Alma. Got a minute for a weather question?
That is the literal definition of my job. What's up?
Paper rustled on the other end of the line.
Planet a picnic?
No. I pulled the equations I'd been working on closer. I'm helping Nathaniel figure out how big the meteorite was, and composition, and... The Chesapeake was steaming for 3 days. I could sort it out on my own, but I thought there might be an existing equation for figuring out what temperature it would take to make a body of water that big steam.
Interesting. Give me a sec.
Beyond him, I could hear the teletype bringing in reports from weather stations around the world.
You've got the depth and volume of water, I assume.
Average depth 21 feet, 18 trillion gallons.
Okay, so, during March, the Chesapeake Bay is around 44 degrees, so we'd need a temperature change of 199.4.
A drawer opened and the timbre of his voice changed.
I could picture him with the phone pressed between cheek and shoulder, brows creased as he worked the slide rule. His crutches would be leaning against the edge of his desk. His glasses would be down at the tip of his nose to help him focus better. And he'd have the corner of his lower lip tucked between his teeth, humming between muttered phrases.
Divided by water's molar mass, and that gives me 1.54 E20J of energy. Adding the two energies together, 1.84 E20J of energy you'd need. It would need to be approximately 518 degrees.
Thanks. I swallowed at the number and tried not to betray how much it frightened me. You could have just given me the formula.
What? And admit that my kid sister is better at math than I am?
He snorted.
Please, I have an ego.
I could now plug the temperature into an equation that took the approximate angle of entry into account. And that should tell me generally what sort of composition we were looking at, based on what would heat to 518 degrees during passage through the air. It wouldn't be precise, but it would be good enough for Nathaniel's purposes.
You said you were figuring out what the meteor was.
The timbre changed again as he brought the receiver closer to his mouth. Yeah, based on the size of the crater, 18 miles, and the initial water displacement, I have a pretty good estimate of the meteorite's size. I started noodling with the numbers that he'd given me. At some point, they'll get divers down to find out its actual composition, but everyone is focused on the refugee and recovery efforts. And that made me think of Eugene and Myrtle.
Maybe you can answer a question for me.
I'm not doing your math homework. He snorted.
How's Nathaniel doing?
Oh. I sighed and checked the door to make sure it was shut. He's exhausted and frustrated, and a bunch of it is classified, so... I keep thinking it'll be better when everything is over, but...
But it's not going to be over.
No. I rubbed my forehead. How is it out there?
We're just starting to see refugees, but mostly it's business as usual.
He sighed.
That's going to change when the weather patterns start to shift.
Shift how?
I'm not sure exactly, but that's what I'm working on. That much sediment and smoke in the air.
I could imagine him pulling his glasses off as he sighed.
Maybe you can answer another question for me.
I'm still not doing your math homework for you.
Yes, you are, actually. What was the water displacement?
I'll be able to give you an approximate value once I know how big the thing was. Why?
Because you kick that much water up into the air and it's going to have an impact on the weather. I want to see if we can predict what the hurricane season is going to be like because of this.
I smiled at the wall as if Herschel were sitting opposite me. Okay, fine. I'll do your math homework, but you know the deal.
Yes.
He laughed.
You can read my comic books. But that is going to require coming to visit.
As soon as we're finished here. Once Nathaniel was finished with his meetings, I'd talk to him about maybe moving to California. I shoved the calculations away from me and rested my head on my hands. Crap. It had taken me 2 evenings to get all the variables lined up, and now? I'd gone through the numbers 3 times, and if there was a mistake, I wasn't finding it. I'd called Herschel, but it was after work hours and they were out for the evening. Goodness knows what their babysitter made of my message. Pushing back from the desk, I stood and paced around the study. A casserole sat congealing on the table next to me. Myrtle had brought it in at some point. Part of it was gone and the fork was dirty, but I had no memory of eating anything. An ache ran from my right eye and over the top of my head. I needed Nathaniel. I gathered the pages together, both my original calculations about the meteorite impact and the tidier sheets where I'd reworked them. He would still be at HQ. I could... What? Pull him out of a meeting? Nothing on these pages would change if I waited for him to come home. But I needed my husband, and I needed him now. Rubbing the ache above my eye eased it a little. If my math wasn't wrong, then some of the original data must be. One of the reports probably exaggerated numbers. I must be wrong. I snatched the plate off the table and carried it into the kitchen. The house was dark except for the light over the stove. Nathaniel needed to come home. And he would, probably not too much longer. I could be patient. I scraped the rest of the casserole into the garbage, then stood at the sink to wash the dish. The Lindholms had a shiny new dishwasher, but the water running over my hands calmed me. After I put the dish in the rack, I stood for a moment and let the water trickle through my fingers. The front door opened. Thank God. I wiped my hands on the dish towel and ran to meet Nathaniel. He smiled when he saw me and leaned in for a kiss.
Hello, beautiful.
I need to show you something. I winced. Sorry, I mean, how was your day? Convince them that the Russians aren't after us yet?
Not quite. And now President Brennan wants to restart NACA and have us look for other asteroids.
He loosened his tie.
What did you want to show me?
It can wait until morning. This was me trying to be a good wife despite my anxiety, because truly, showing him tonight would accomplish nothing beyond making him as sleepless as me.
Elma, no. I don't want to be kicked all night.
Kicked?
Yeah. When you're this worked up, you toss and kick in your sleep.
How do you argue about what you do when you're asleep? Do I hurt you?
Let's just say that I'd like to see whatever it is.
Really, I needed no convincing at all. I grabbed his hand and pulled him into the study. I was trying to calculate how much energy it would take to move the meteor to prove that there was no way the Russians could have done it. He stopped in the doorway.
Please don't tell me that they could have done it.
No. In a way, that would have been better. I stood next to the desk and looked at the pages covered with calculations. No, but I think this could be an extinction event. 8.
Feed grain prices crash. Chicago, March 26, 1952, AP. Feed grains dropped significantly on the Board of Trade today in a continuation of the preceding session's crash. Brokers thought the downturn, both today and yesterday, was based largely on the fact that export of corn and oats were blocked due to harbor damage on the East Coast ports.
God help me, I wanted to be wrong. Nathaniel sat at the desk in the Lindholm study and worked his slide rule, double-checking my calculations. The desk was scattered with encyclopedias, almanacs, atlases, and newspapers from the last week, with reports of where damage was showing. I leaned against the wall next to the window, chewing on the inside of my lip. The night outside had started to turn silver, and if I had any more coffee, I would vibrate through the ceiling. He hadn't asked me any questions for the last hour. Every time his pencil scratched against the paper, I hoped it was an error, that I'd forgotten to invert a differential or square a root or something. Anything. Finally, he set the slide rule on the desk and rested his head on his fingertips. He stared at the last page.
We have to get off this fucking planet.
Nathaniel! Why I was chiding him about language, I couldn't tell you.
Sorry.
He sighed, sliding his hands over his head until his face was hidden between his arms. His voice was muffled against the table.
I really wanted you to be wrong.
My starting numbers might be off.
If they're that far off, someone at Encyclopedia Americana should be fired.
He sat up, still scrubbing his face and squinting.
I thought we had gotten lucky that the meteorite was a water strike.
It's the steam that's the problem. I crossed the room to sit on the desk, but Nathaniel caught my wrist and pulled me down onto his lap. I leaned against him and rested my head on his. Things are going to get cold for a bit, and then all that water vapor in the air. He nodded.
I'll see if I can get you a meeting with the president.
The president? Heart kicking sideways, I straightened a bit. It's just... I mean, a lot of this involves stuff that's not in my field of study, and maybe we should talk to other scientists?
Sure. But right now they've got me and Wernher von Braun working on a program to spot other potential asteroids and blow them up with rockets.
He leaned back in the chair and scratched one of the scabs on his chin.
You know military bureaucracy as well as I do.
Once a program starts, it's hard to stop. He nodded.
And we're working on the wrong damn problem.
I stood in front of the closet, staring at my meager wardrobe. Every time I reached for a dress, my stomach knotted itself. Everyone would be staring at me. What if I picked the wrong dress? What if my calculations were wrong? It would be better for Nathaniel if I stayed home instead of going with him to meet the general.
Elma, which tie should I... You're not dressed?
Nathaniel stopped just inside the door to our room.
We're supposed to meet General Eisenhower in 30 minutes.
He had a borrowed tie in each hand.
The blue one. It brings out your eyes. I shut the door to the closet, and the knot in my stomach immediately loosened.
Are you okay?
He lowered the ties and came over to feel my forehead. Just a little under the weather. I was having my period, but that wasn't the problem. I would milk it, though, for all it was worth, if it meant I could avoid this meeting. But I've got the report typed up for you, and you understand the equations as well as I do.
That is a serious exaggeration.
He set the green tie down on the desk.
If they have any questions, I'm not sure I'm equipped to answer them.
They? Of course it would be a crowd. It was one thing to follow Nathaniel into a meeting as support or to argue with Parker, but get more than six men in a room and all the old memories came back. I wiped my palms on my dressing gown, still nervous even though I wouldn't be going. The general likely won't be able to follow the equations anyway, so all you have to do is talk about the conclusions. He sighed and looped the tie around the back of his neck.
That's what I was planning on doing. I wanted you there for the things I couldn't answer, like the correlation between steam in the air and increased global temperatures.
I grabbed one of the reports I'd typed up and flipped through the pages. That's on page 4, and there's a graph at the back that shows the rise in temperature over the next 50 years, so...
I know.
They'll believe it coming from you. They won't if I explain it.
Please. He turned from the mirror. Which of us was a math tutor in college? You're brilliant at explaining things.
My husband was a good man. He believed in me. And he also had a huge blind spot because he didn't see how people would ignore what I said until he repeated it. It doesn't matter. I just don't feel well, okay? Nathaniel wrapped the tie into a Windsor and snugged the sharp knot up against his collar.
Sorry, I'd just been planning on having you there, but if you don't feel well, you don't feel well.
I shrank a little into my bathrobe. Today's not a good day.
When is? We haven't had a good day since the meteorite struck.
It's a feminine...
Got it.
He frowned and rubbed his brow. Shaking his head, he grabbed his jacket from the back of the chair.
Well, this is just a precursor to meeting the president. You'll be better for that one.
The problem was that I wouldn't be better. Meeting the president would be infinitely worse. But at least it wasn't happening today. And maybe I wouldn't be needed, or maybe my security clearance wouldn't be high enough, or something would save me from having to stand in front of a room full of men. I'm an intelligent woman. I understood that there was absolutely no danger. I really, truly did. And yet, going to high school when you are 11 years old, being the only girl in a mathematics class, repeatedly, going to college at 14, having everyone stare at you because you can do math in your head, having boys hate you, because you never get questions wrong in class, being used as a tool by professor after professor, look, even this little girl knows the answer. By the time I left college, I would do anything to avoid speaking in front of a group. I cleared my throat. Have you met him before?
The president or Eisenhower? I mean, yes, either way, but only briefly.
General Eisenhower and Daddy used to golf together.
See, this is why I want you there.
Because of who my dad is? Was? Whatever. I slapped the report back down on the desk. I can't go. He sighed again and stared at the floor.
I'm sorry. I'm being selfish because I'm nervous.
Nathaniel walked over and wrapped his arms around me.
Is there anything you need today? Hot water bottle? Chocolate?
Empty promises. Where do you think you'll get chocolate? With the ports on the East Coast still closed, the grocery store shelves were already getting thin.
I'll requisition it from General Eisenhower.
On what grounds?
That the fate of the world depends on keeping my wife healthy and happy.
He kissed my forehead.
I'm not even sure it's an exaggeration.
There's a cascading effect that happens when you lie about not feeling well. I was supposed to go volunteer at the hospital after meeting with Eisenhower. After Nathaniel left, Myrtle knocked on my door. I buttoned the last button on my blouse. Come in. Using her foot, Myrtle pushed the door open. She had a tray with some saltines and a glass of ginger ale.
Nathaniel said you weren't feeling well.
Oh, it's just, you know, feminine complaints. I tucked in my shirt so I wouldn't have to face her. The worst seems to have passed, actually.
I know every woman is different, but mine lays me out for an entire day.
She set the tray down on the little desk in our room, so I brought you some things.